fall. Baby, it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a very interesting and a very fine guest this evening. He's a transplant from England, but we welcome him with open arms. He's the author of Maggie's Hammer. Okay, it's a very intriguing book, and you just got to go out and get this one. It's on Amazon and everything. I want to welcome to our program Jeffrey Gilson. Welcome to our program, Mr. Gilson.
Well, thank you, George. Please call me Jeff.
Okay.
Thank you for having me on The Secret Truth. And I am a bit of a transplant, but just to make your listeners feel a little more comfortable with me, bearing in mind my accent, my parents were, in fact, American, but I was born and raised in England. And I have a very special connection to Texas and to Austin. I have two brothers who live in Texas, one in Dallas and one in Houston. I have a sister in Houston. I have a niece in Dallas. And my nephew went to the University of Texas in Austin. Go Longhorns.
Well, I think you've been Americanized. We've adopted you then, right?
There you go, man.
You come to Texas, we'll take you to the Alamo.
There you go.
Down in San Antonio. Tell our listening audience a little bit of your background and then your motivation and first that motivated you to write this book.
Okay, well, as your listeners probably know, the book is called Maggie's Hammer. It's very easy to find access to my website, because the website's maggieshammer.com. And if you Google Maggie's Hammer, about the only thing you will find is my book, because there's nothing else out there called Maggie's Hammer. George, I am like any one of your listeners. I am just an ordinary guy. Grew up in a very small town in England, population of about 11,000 people. I was leading an ordinary life. I expected to spend the rest of my life in that little town. I worked with a lawyer friend who was a bit older than me. We were both of us interested in politics and aiming to be members of parliament in Great Britain until one day, November 1988, he turns up dead in the woods. And almost immediately we discovered that missing from the account to which he was the sole signatory was some $7 million. None of this made any sense to me. He had a lot of flaws as a character, as a lot of politicians. He was a fairly arrogant guy, but I liked him, but he had some flaws. But the theft and the suicide didn't make any sense. Well, the authorities stopped looking very quickly because they said, money's missing, he's dead, that's the answer. My problem was I was very close to his family, and he left behind three very small children. And, George, if you've ever had to hold the hands of an 11-year-old girl, look into her eyes and explain that you do not know why her father just committed suicide, it's not an experience I ever want to go through again. And so I determined that I was just going to try and find the truth. Since the authorities weren't asking questions, I started asking questions, which, amazingly enough, they didn't much care for, and which is very much the theme of my book. How do we take back what should be ours if there are people saying we can't do it? Well, I ignored them. And so I started asking questions in what quickly became apparent were the wrong places. And it turns out that my friend Hugh Simmons was a bit of a Walter Mitty character, that on the face of it, he was an ordinary guy, but underneath the surface, he was apparently a very senior officer in MI6, was very closely connected to Margaret Thatcher, and was arranging all sorts of secret deals and so forth for her, all of which are in the book. And I continued with my investigations and went where they went, and I ended up talking to Israeli intelligence agents in Montreal. I got shot at in Glasgow, Scotland. I was warned off by the CIA in London. I had an amazing adventure and discovered all sorts of interesting details about the way governments in Great Britain and America have been cooperating in their clandestine activity. I haven't got all the answers because I'm just one man, and my book isn't so much an exposé as it is a starting point, as it is a big question mark, as it is a challenge and an invitation to all the people who read it, please to help me find the answers so that I can conclude this investigation.
You know, you picked a very good publisher, because Trine Day, Chris Milligan, is a guy that stands up for truth, okay?
Chris is wonderful. Chris and I have never met.
Yeah.
Last year, he accepted me completely on faith. He read the manuscript. He said, yep, this is what I'm going to publish. And I asked blunt questions. I said, why? And he said, because this is a book that should be out there.
Right.
And I said,
right.
But do you know if it's going to succeed or not? He said, I don't care, Jeff.
Right.
For one reason or another, I'm in a position where I can publish the books I think need to be out there.
Right.
And he's been very, very kind to me.
Right. Hugh Simmons was your best friend. Is that one the one that committed suicide supposedly? But was it real suicide or not?
That is correct. I mean, certainly he turned up dead. And this is interesting, George.
Right.
As I say, I'm an ordinary guy. I decided to poke around and ask some questions because the authorities had stopped doing it. But I didn't have access to research tools or whatever. So when he died, I mean, people have said to me, well, what did the autopsy say? And I said, autopsy? I was comforting his wife. I was comforting his children. My life had been turned upside down. I was held in suspicion as the primary accomplice. Looking at the autopsy report, that was the last thing I thought was thinking about at that stage. Besides which, all of the revelations about intelligence activity, working for Margaret Thatcher, connections to Ronald Reagan through Tony Blair and so on, that didn't come along until later, by which time it was too late. So I have no scientific evidence, one way or the other, whether it was suicide. Although, once you look into these matters, it is fairly easy these days to make a death look like anything you wanted to make it look like. But what I have had happen is, during the course of speaking with various intelligence officers in both the Israeli intelligence and British intelligence, I have been told, and this is in the book, I have been told that he was murdered, that he did not go to that woodland spot to commit suicide. He went there to meet someone who was supposed to get him out of the country.
Right. Right after his death, you said that the intelligence operatives pulled you in. Did they interrogate you? Or tell us about that. What happened?
No, they didn't pull me in. In fact, I went looking for them.
Okay.
Because I was trying to work out ordinary things like, okay, well, did he lose this money? Did he use this money to try and make some money quick on the stock market? Why
right.
did he do that? The rules for lawyers and clients' money are just as strict in England as they are here. You touch your client's money, you're finished. You go to prison. But I thought about these things, and I was getting headaches trying to work out.
And how much money was in question now? How much money?
$7.5 million.
$7.5 million, okay. And,
yeah.
and it was alleged that a client had entrusted him with the money and it was missing, right? Is that it?
Well, various clients. I mean, the money came from various sources. It was clients who were buying houses.
Oh, a number of clients, you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So at first, that's where my mind was. And everything changed when, in fact, his father, who I had been speaking with, came to me and said, I don't know whether there's any truth to this or not, but I'm going to pass this message on because I was asked to pass it on. I've been approached by two people I cannot name, people of credibility, who tell me that the money disappeared because he was helping to get an agent out of a foreign country, and he was doing this clandestinely on behalf of the government. Well, that's when I realized that Hugh had spoken from time to time about being in British intelligence. But, George, it's kind of like the guy you meet at the bar, at the end of the bar, who's slightly drunk, who says, you know, I used to be in the Navy SEALs. You hear the stories, and you kind of accept it, because it's Hank. Hank's always got a good story. So he would sort of say this to me in much the same way. And one time I said to him, why are you telling me this stuff? Why are you doing this stuff around me? I mean, I am not in the slightest bit interested. And he said, because I want you one day to be my insurance, just in case. So I'd completely forgotten about this until his father told me this. And that's what triggered me to start looking at intelligence matters. And I remembered a friend of his whom Hugh had told me had been in intelligence with him in Scotland. And I went, literally, which is what I'd done throughout this book, I just went knocking on his door. And he said to me, this is kind of a stupid thing to do. You don't have any idea who I am. And I said, well, I've got to do what I've got to do. And that's when the roller coaster began, because that's when we ended up a couple of days later getting shot at. And then from then on, I was looking at intelligence matters. He told me that he confirmed that what Hugh had been involved in and the reason the money had gone missing from his client's account had to do with some clandestine operation.
Right. You say in there that you had people follow you at different times during this period, or what?
Well, yes. A couple of months after Hugh died, because of my American family, I decided to move to America, make a new start for myself, checked with everything, checked with everyone to make sure it was okay, and I was told by the police and by the Law Society, which is the equivalent of the American National Bar Association, that, yeah, sure, you know, fine. And about 2 months after I got to America, they rang me and turned up, you know, and said that we need to come and interview you. And I was like, why? Well, because we can't find the money, so now we're looking for people and you're top of the list. I said, well, you know, you did tell me I was in the clear. Now this is kind of, you know, kind of inconvenient because I've got to clear my name and you're not doing anything about it. And so that's why I got involved. George, I've completely forgotten what your question was.
Well, what I'm trying to get to here is that you were followed at times, is that right?
Oh yes.
And
well,
and there was this three car you know, you have, you described this so well from the first person, you know, and you're using those intelligence terms and stuff, you know.
That's very kind. I mean, I can only describe it in the way that I can.
Yeah.
And I've been very kindly told by one or two reviewers that it reads, it's a very racy read. It's an adventure story. I'm not an expert on matters relating to political intrigue. I only know what I experienced. I only know what I was told, and that's what I try faithfully to record in my book, hopefully in a way that people find interesting to read.
Yes.
But yes, at that point I had to go back to England on my own cost and start asking questions. And I took my brother-in-law with me, but it became very clear very quickly that we were being followed. And when I went to have an interview with the police and with the Law Society, I told them this, and both the police and the Law Society later confirmed to me that they had placed people at windows to see what was happening. And yes, indeed, when I left both places, I was followed by three cars. This was a very professional operation. And the police checked into some license plates, some license tags that I'd given them, and they came back and said there are two license tags that are unusual. One is a private detective firm in Surrey, and the other belongs to an organization we can't talk about.
And really?
What does that mean?
Man.
Fill in the gaps.
Right.
So, yes.
So you were followed, and probably your phone was tapped too, and all that, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I had interesting clicks and echoes on my telephone.
Right, right. And that's pretty easily done. You know, you say that Margaret Thatcher inherited a government that was an economic or country that needed to be turned around economically. Did she begin to do that through arms manufacturing, or what? What was one of her main goals, was to increase industrial, I mean, arms sales, or what?
Yes, I mean, as your listeners will determine if they read the book. After speaking to this intelligence operative up in Scotland, I just started researching as much as I could to find anything that sounded like the sort of operation that he was describing. And if I found people who seemed to be talking, writing about the same thing, I simply wrote to them or telephoned them to find out if they knew my friend or knew of anything like that. And out of the blue, I wrote to a former Israeli intelligence officer who'd written a very interesting book. And in the middle of this book, he talked about Mossad teams being sent to Great Britain in November of 1988 to kill people involved with arms sales to Iraq. Well, my information had nothing to do with arms sales to Iraq, but I contacted him because the dates fit. And he came back to me 48 hours later and said, it's fascinating. I've checked with the people that I know, and your friend's name is on one of our lists, and we had no idea who he was until you approached us. That opened up everything in my book. I met with this person over the course of 3 or 4 years, and he was kind of cagey, but he gave me quite a bit of information. And that information was that my friend was part of a team of people associated with Margaret Thatcher, but one step removed from her, who engaged all sorts of security operations in respect of her covert foreign policy. And that included arms deals. And one of the things that Margaret Thatcher was faced with when she took power in 1979 was a country that was pretty much bankrupt. I mean, we know about this at the moment because we see it with Greece. But Great Britain was Greece in the 1970s. It had no money. No one had any money, and British industry was failing. So the first thing that she determined to do was to expand British industry by pumping up arms sales. And during her term in office, Britain went from being like the number 7 arms exporter to the world's number 2. The problem is, if you're going to become a supplier of weaponry, you have to have consistency. And that means you have to be able to supply a country with the spare parts of the airplanes that you sold them for 10 or 20 years. Whoever is in power, whether it's a democratic government or a dictator, which means that you have people who you can deal with by the front door, and you have people you have to deal with by the back door when you're dealing with countries that are embargoed. And my friend, I am told, was part of that backdoor operation, and his specialty was laundering the money back to senior politicians, including Margaret Thatcher, arms kickbacks,
right,
and other activity.
Right. You say that there was some dealing with Iran during this period. Is that right? Arms
yes,
sales.
My information from the Israeli intelligence officer is that in the 80s, the Middle East, and it hasn't changed all that much, which is why the book is interesting. People say, this is all in the 80s. Why on earth would that interest now? Because almost everything that is happening around the world at the moment, with the American government, with the British government, with the relations between them, Russia, Iran, Syria, all that were happening is happening now. The groundwork was laid in the 80s. If you want to know what's happening, you have to understand the 80s. And I'm told very kindly that my book is one of the best books for understanding the clandestine activity in the 80s, which is why it's a good book to read. And it's called, by the way, everyone, Maggie's Hammer. Now, in the 80s, the primary military conflict was the war between Iran and Iraq. And both countries were embargoed by the United Nations. Other countries were not supposed to be selling them weapons, but everybody did. And it was a candy store. Some $80 billion in weaponry was sold illegally to Iran, and some $60 billion was sold illegally to Iraq. And this has been fairly well documented in many other books besides mine. Every major Western country was involved in selling arms to these two countries illegally and by the back door. And apparently, as I say, my friend was involved in helping to organize some of those arms sales with the Israeli intelligence officer. This is the interesting thing, because the Israeli intelligence contact that I had, I'd been speaking to him for about 2 years, and he'd been feeding me this information until one day a light bulb went off in my head. And the next time we met, perhaps somewhat stupidly, I said, I get the feeling you're not telling me everything. And he said, well, I said, I think you knew, my friend. And the meeting went very dark. It was the first and last time I actually felt in fear of my life talking to this guy. And he said, why do you say that? And I explained. And he said, okay, yes, I'm not saying I know this because your friend's name is on a list. I know this because I worked with him, but he wasn't using that name. So
was this Ari Ben Menashe that you were talking about?
That was Ari Ben Menashe, who was a
very interesting
character. Yeah, he's an interesting character.
He's very, very, he's connected into Israeli intelligence, is that it?
Well, he's very controversial. There are very divided opinions about Ari Ben Menashe, which is interesting on its own, because there are those people who rubbish him and say the man is full of hot air, and yet at the same time, they bother to talk about him. He lives free in Canada, and
right.
is a consultant to Canadian intelligence, and the strange thing is this, George, the very same people who denigrate him are the very same people who go and consult with him.
So, well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I explain, I go into this somewhat in my book, and I examine Ari very carefully. And I've said this bluntly to his face, perhaps not all that wisely, that people who are involved in intelligence, they lie. That's what they do for a living. And some of it's genuine, and some of it's just because they are children who never grew up. The weirdest people are involved in intelligence. Intelligence is not people in intelligence aren't angels. They're not Boy Scouts. They're very weird. They're a little bit dysfunctional, primarily so that they're deniable. And Ari is definitely one of those. And I am sure that there is some stuff that he says that is not true. And therefore, you have to be able to examine it very carefully to make sure that it fits what you want. And the same thing is true of my book. As I say, George, I'm an ordinary guy. I've chronicled what happened to me. Yes, it was an interesting adventure. Yes, I've been told some things which put a new angle on much of clandestine history over the last 30 years. But, you know, your listeners are intelligent. They're going to need to read the book and make up their own mind. They might come to different conclusions, and that's fine, because all we can do is go on with the information that we're given. But Ari is a very interesting character. Frankly, I like him. I kind of like rogues. He's a charming person. In the middle of talking about arms kickbacks and Margaret Thatcher and hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes and clandestine activity and assassination, we were talking about this in an Indian restaurant with Ari and his wife, and they were utterly charming, and it was surreal. It was like an episode of Seinfeld, but with guns.
Oh, my gosh. I think later on in your book, you say that Chris Milligan vetted through Ari some of your assertions. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm very grateful to Chris, but I'm also very grateful to Ari. I hadn't spoken to Ari in 20 years.
Right.
And Chris said, look, I want to publish this book, but I've got to be clearly there's no written evidence, because if there was bank statements, you'd be talking to the New York Times. I said, yes. And he said, that's fine, but I need some confirmation that what you're saying actually happened, that you actually had these conversations. And I said, well, I will give you the names and telephone numbers of the primary characters in my book, the most important of which is Ari Benanashi. You go off and have a conversation with him. Don't involve me. You've got to confirm this for yourself. And Chris came back and said, Ari confirms absolutely everything. And I was kind of surprised. I half expected Ari to turn around and say, no, I've never heard of this guy before in my life. But he didn't. He's confirmed everything. And indeed, he very kindly provided a quote to put on the back of the book to emphasize the fact that he absolutely meant everything that he said. And it's extraordinary. I mean, I find this man out of nowhere. But he meant everything that he said, and that everything that he said was true.
Yeah, right here, this is one of the quotes from Ari Menashe. In the 80s, Margaret Thatcher attempted dramatically to rebuild British industry by rapidly expanding arms sales in the UK. In this regard, the British Conservative Party sold arms to Iraq with help from Israel, and the Labour Party with Robert Maxwell, and they sold arms to Iran also. Jeff's friend, Hugh Simmons, was one of the team who laundered the political kickback from such sales. Is that pretty accurate?
Yes, that is what I'm told by Ari. One of the questions that people like you, George, are asking is, okay, well, that's very interesting. What's that got to do with America or Great Britain now? And the answer is, it's still continuing. In my book, I carry on forward from the 80s, and arms dealing has been a primary feature of the British export market all the way through the years of Tony Blair, and through the years of David Cameron. My information is that the arms commissions to politicians continue to the tune of, wait for this figure, $300 million a year. I am told that the British body politic is thoroughly corrupted. 20 years ago, nobody would have believed this, but now there have been a number of scandals involving British politicians, and I think people are ready to believe it. And I've spoken with some figures in Great Britain, and there has been a very well-known investigation undertaken by a newspaper in London, the Guardian newspaper, into Britain's leading defense firm, British Aerospace. And they've proven that there were arms kickbacks. They've proven that there were bribes. But they can only prove it to industry sources. They can only prove that there were kickbacks to people in the Middle East. They can't make the connection to politicians. And so they, people say to me, why do you know something they don't? And I say, accident. Accident. I happen to know and be good friends with the guy who set up the money laundering links. And the reason you can't find the money trail now is because he's dead.
Right. You know, Robert Maxwell was involved in some of this. Is that right?
Robert, that is my information, that Robert Maxwell, on behalf of the Labour Party, was heavily involved in arms
sales. So both parties were involved in this arms sales and so forth, the Conservative and Labour?
That's my information, yes.
Okay, so...
Indeed, later on in my conversations with Ari told me that Hugh was working with Robert Maxwell.
Right. Victor Ostrowski, the name, is that familiar with that name? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, he's not somebody I ever spoke to.
How does he factor into the overall story here?
Well, as you will understand, I'm being told all this information. No one's handing me pieces of paper. No one's handing me photographs. I'm being told this information, but I have to find some way to be able to determine whether there's any credence to it at all.
Sure.
So I went off and did my own research. I'm a lawyer. I know how to do research, and I must have read about 350 books, and I very carefully list them in a bibliography at the end of my book, trying to make sense of how this all fits together. And I don't know, George, maybe I hit a good day, but I managed to put things together in a way that other books didn't. And, in fact, one or two very well-known journalists have written to me and said, this is our area of expertise, and you have put things together in a way we've never put together before, but it makes sense. And I was trying to understand Ari Ben-Menashe, and we talk about issues in black and white, and I've been told to think about them in terms of gray. Israel is a very strange country. It's very, very politicized. The bureaucracy is politicized. So its intelligence services aren't singular. In every branch of intelligence, whether it's the air intelligence or the Navy intelligence or Mossad, there are political factions. Ari belonged to the right-wing political faction within one of the Israeli intelligence branches. Victor Ostrowski was in one of the left-wing factions. And the one similarity between the two of them is they came out and wrote books. And I set out in my book how it's very clear that they were unofficially, officially encouraged to write these books to promulgate the views of their political factions within Israeli intelligence, because the left wing and the right wing had very different ambitions. The left wing in Israeli intelligence believes that the war between Israel and its neighbors should be kept geographically to the Middle East. The right wing faction under Ari Ben-Menashe says, no, this is a global fight to save the state of Israel, and we will fight it wherever we have to. And if there are politicians in Great Britain who are opposed to what we stand for, then we will deal with it. Then we will remove them. We will take them out. We will do whatever we have to do. And that's how he became involved with my friend Hugh, because he was pursuing activity in Great Britain to further the agenda of his faction within Israeli intelligence. And that's the only reason that Victor Ostrowski figures in my book. I never met him, never spoke with him, but I was comparing the two books that Ari and Victor produced.
How do the secret societies in Great Britain, UK, how do they interact, or do they dominate much of the highest level elitist that rule Great Britain, or what?
Well, when you say secret societies, what are you referring to?
Well, like the Templars. I mean, you have a couple of books in here. I think that you're the Templars, Secret Island, and the Templar in the Lodge. But see, that Templar Church is in the City of London, and that money power is very great.
Well, here's the thing, George. Yeah. I'm bound to say that before 1988, I was not much of a conspiracy theorist. I grew up in a small town.
Right.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that stuff. Well, let me put it like this. I didn't believe any of this until it landed on my doorstep.
Sure.
And the British intelligence source that I spoke with in Glasgow made very clear to me, he said, look, it doesn't matter whether you believe what the secret societies believe in, whether you believe there is some organization which is protecting the heir of Jesus. He said, the fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, these secret societies have existed for 1,000 years, and they are intricately interwoven with the activity of official intelligence agencies. And he said, why? Because they're great secret networks. If you want to organize certain activity, like getting money into Eastern Europe to bring down the Soviet Union, they've got networks established, so you'd be stupid not to use them. So he said, yes, you're going to find these secret societies. And he said, frankly, I belong to one of them because I need the information. So I no longer completely denigrate the existence of secret societies. I'm not sure that I agree with everything they agree with, but yes, they are very much.
Well, I noticed a couple of books also in your bibliography, Holy Blood, mm-hmm. Holy Grail, and The Messianic yep. Legacy. I read both of those.
Yes.
And so they're coming in from this angle from the secret society, aren't they?
But, yes, well,
but
well,
in
they
a,
are.
In a long term, over centuries, several centuries.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
oh,
over,
yes.
And, yeah, long term.
It's what I was told is, don't look too closely at what they believe and what they don't believe, but take them seriously, because they're out there, they're operating, and they are part of the picture. Indeed, as I mentioned Eastern Europe, it's a bit difficult for some of your younger listeners to recall that they see what Russia's doing now, but the Cold War is not necessarily something they remember or understand. But you and I, George, know, you know, how important it was as a feature of the politics of the 70s and of the last
century. Yeah, I was in West Berlin in 65 when doing intelligence
okay.
work. See?
So yeah. And it also dominated all clandestine activity around the world, the struggle between the Soviet
right.
Union
right.
and the United States. And particularly in terms of Eastern Europe, bringing down the Iron Curtain, freeing East Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, all those countries we now regard as being part of Central Europe were then Eastern Europe. And these secret societies were primarily based in those parts of the world. And my intelligence source in Scotland said, if you want to understand what Hugh might have been involved with, and the people he might have been involved with, you have to look at the secret societies and understand them, because part of the problem is, and he said he was convinced that Hugh had been murdered. And he said part of the reasoning for that was that Hugh got involved in things he didn't entirely understand and may have upset one faction or another, whether it was the Israelis, whether it was the secret society. But my British intelligence source said the reason he died is because he didn't understand what he was dealing with. And if you, Jeffrey, want to understand why, you, Jeffrey, have to read about this and understand it. You don't have to believe it. You just have to understand it, which is why I read all those books.
Well, you know, you
I
just said that that bibliography, I've forgotten how many books that you read.
About 350.
Well, you know, I look back in the back of your book here, and by gosh, every one of them's listed. You're not exaggerating.
Yeah.
You know that, Jeff?
Yeah,
you're not just puffing the bibliography.
I don't think I ever want to read another book, although I
right.
do want your listeners to read my book.
Oh, yes. I think your book, I just finished it yesterday, and it is very, very interesting. And I have, you know, some... you know, like I said, some intelligence background in West Berlin. So I understand uh-huh. this on a long-term basis, too, you know.
Yeah.
And I've read many of these books that you're referring to in your bibliography. But getting back to, say, Margaret Thatcher's administration, did
yeah.
not she pursue a public-private partnership type of or privatization? And then she did a little bit of union breaking over there, and what, to make the economy more efficient? Is that what her aim was?
Well, her ambition, and back in those days, I mean, my politics has somewhat changed, but back in those days I was quite very active with the British Conservative Party.
Okay.
We took the view then that the economy had been wrecked by socialism.
Okay.
And that the pendulum needed to swing back. We needed to denationalize some industries, reduce the power of the unions, free up the economy,
sure.
improve social mobility. Not everyone agreed. We made some mistakes. My politics has changed a little bit. I find myself a little bit more near the center than I do on the right wing now. But I'm still a member of the British Conservative Party, although in America I may upset some people by saying this. I tend to vote Democrat. But
Before Margaret Thatcher went out of power, they were trying to get her to privatize the railroad, and she was against it. And then I think that occurred after there was a change in prime minister. And then was the railroad, was that a disaster privatizing that or what? What happened then?
It's kind of like the whole health thing, too.
Yeah.
People talk about the disasters of the American health system, and they say, what we need is a system like you have in Great Britain, which is nationalized. And I say, you know something? They have exactly the same problems for exactly the same reasons. There are some things that just are big and don't work too well. And, you know, trains just basically don't run on time. I hate to say that, George, but the only people in the world who have ever managed to get the trains to run on time were dictators. And
the German trains run on time, though, Jeff.
Oh, the German trains always run on time.
I guess they salute there on the platform, right?
So you have to make a choice, George. You either want democracy and bad trains, or you want good trains and dictatorship.
That's a good choice, isn't it?
It's interesting in a way because the government that followed Margaret Thatcher for 13 years was the administration of Tony Blair, which was a Labour administration, and he upset a lot of his supporters because he was a fan of Margaret Thatcher and in many ways continued many of her policies, and that upset a lot of Labour supporters, and we're seeing, I think, the consequence for that in England at the moment, where there's an election for the leader of the Labour Party, and the gentleman who is far and away in the lead is somebody who is very, very to the left of the party. And the British media are thoroughly confused as to why this is happening. And I don't think the reason is so much the politics as it is that particularly in the last 30 years, on both sides of the Atlantic, and I think this is the same reason we're seeing support for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in America, people are sick and tired of seeing the same thing. We put different politicians in power up there. They say they're going to listen to us. They say they're going to do this. And we get the same stuff. And I think more and more ordinary people like you and me, George, and your listeners feel that we do not control our own lives, that there's very little that we can do to design our own destiny. And that's one of the reasons I did what I did and one of the reasons I wrote my book, was because I wanted to poke someone in the eye and say, do you know something? I know you think you got away with this. I know you think you control my life, but actually you don't. And that's the primary message I want ordinary people to get from this book. Yes, it's an adventure. Yes, it's a bit of an expose. But the most important thing is please treat it as a guide to what you as an ordinary person can do to start asking questions about the things going on around you that don't add up. We don't have to accept it. And if each of us, one by one, starts asking questions of what's going on locally, in our county and in our state, we become an army of activists and we take back our country.
You know, people have to become active. Here in this country, we're pursuing like a local political action type of mechanism. See, go out there and start changing out some of these local politicians and try to get some good people in there, see. But the corruption is so wide in this country, and you're describing a similar situation in the UK, is that the monies, whether it's drug dealing or money laundering or of arms dealing or whatever it might be, the monies are so horrendously huge, humongous.
Yes, and you know what's interesting?
That it's corrupted whole levels of government.
I argue with my friends about that. You say, there's nothing we can do. There's no reason for me to vote because elections are bought and paid for.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, no one is coming and sticking $1 million in my pocket.
I go
and vote because I go and vote. Yes, there's money. There's money buying ads. Don't watch them. There's money buying PACs. Don't listen to them. Nobody can actually buy your vote. But if you choose not to vote, then somebody else is voting for something you don't want.
Well that's a good point.
Go out there and vote. And, you know, the interesting thing is about both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, they have one thing in common. They are both of them refusing corporate donations.
Right.
Now, granted, Donald Trump is rich in his own right. But they, in a weird way, they kind of understand what ordinary people are saying, whether you agree with them or not. We've had enough of people buying our lives. Don't let people buy your life.
Well, that's like why that. We're saying that if you start concentrating on the local political
yep.
levels, you can have mm-hmm. more direct effect. See yeah. what I mean? And try
but,
to get
know,
some people in there. You know, you can see
when
them,
when
you can
started,
meet them. Yeah, go ahead.
When I started asking my questions
right.
back in the little town of Beaconsfield in England, I had no idea I was going to end up exposing what I did. I just wanted to find out what my friend in this little town of 11,000 people had, why he died. We can all do that. I'm sure that every single one of the listeners listening to your show knows of something that was strange. You know, something happened locally that wasn't right. A local congressman did something that didn't add up. And time and again, we just shrug our shoulders and say, well, somebody else will look into that. Don't let somebody else look into it. Don't assume they will.
Right.
Go down and start asking questions. If you don't know how, read my book. It tells you how.
Right.
We do have power.
Right, we do. Getting on to other issues here, you talk about contract employees of British Intelligence Service. Are there people that are freelancers over there, or what? What's that about?
Yes. Well, because it's all clandestine, somebody on a show yesterday asked a question, and they said, if all the stuff was going on with Margaret Thatcher, how did you manage to keep it out of the media? And the answer is because it was organized one or two steps away from her. Hugh was fantastically well-connected. He was about to become a member of parliament, so he knew all the important people in the party, but he wasn't in the eye of the media. He was a senior officer in British intelligence. He could go in and talk to people, but he wasn't in the eye of the media, so he was well-placed. That's why British intelligence, for some of its more, and all intelligence agencies around the world, including American intelligence agencies, for their dirtier work, they don't use the guy sitting in the corner office whose name is on the door. They go out and they use crooks, or they use people who are not immediately visible to do the dirty work, which is why it was so difficult to find the money trail leading to politicians in Great Britain in connection with arms kickbacks, because it was organized by people who were on nobody's radar screen. But here's the interesting thing, George. Every single time I spoke to important agencies, like the Israeli intelligence man, like the British intelligence guy, I spoke with the special agent in charge of U.S. Customs in Miami, who was looking at Margaret Thatcher's son. Every time I went to them with Hugh's name and his details, they came back to me and they said, this is fascinating. We would never in a million years have looked at this guy until you told us to. And now that we have and we check into him, you're right. He is that missing link. But that's the point. We wouldn't have looked at him because he's hidden. So
right.
He is contract agents.
Right. Princess Diana's death, the real target. What did you have to say about that? What happened on Princess Diana?
Well, again, this isn't something I went looking at. Looking for, but
right.
During the course of my investigation, I'd talk to someone, I'd do some research, that would make me go and talk to somebody else, and as I'm going along, I'm being told things, and I add that into the picture. Visually, I have this picture of a huge notice board, like they do in those police rooms on TV, and you have the big notice board with all the lines connecting, and I'm hoping that the lines will get closer and closer so that the big picture becomes clear. And this one was just quite by accident. In 1997, when the British Conservative Party lost power and Labour came in, a number of people were in the British media saying, good, now we can start talking about what the British Conservative Party was doing with arms sales, which caught me completely by surprise because I didn't realize that anybody else knew this. And one of the people who was jumping around talking about this was a gentleman called Mohammed Al-Fayed, who your missed listeners may have heard of. He's the brother-in-law of Adnan Khashoggi and is reputed to have been involved in arms dealing most of his life. And he's very well known in Great Britain. He owns Harrods. He's a billionaire. He owns a football soccer club, but lots of dirty rumors about him. And Mohammed Al-Fayed was jumping around saying, I too am going to expose what the British Conservative Party did. Well, I couldn't work out quite why he knew. And I looked into it, and he owns the Ritz Hotel in Paris. Well, I knew about the Ritz Hotel in Paris. The Ritz Hotel in Paris has, for about 150 years, had a reputation as being safe ground for intelligence agents of different agencies to meet, secret arms deals to be done, and so on. It's generally accepted that if you own the Ritz Hotel, you honor the confidentiality of what takes place there. And at least two or three of the arms deals that I knew about had taken place at that hotel. So I wrote to him out of the blue, as he did, and said, well, do you happen to, have you ever come across the name Hugh Simmons? Was he ever in your hotel? Here's a picture. Did you ever know him? And I ended the letter by saying, you know, I don't know you, but I've got to say, you know, you're jumping around in the British media saying you're going to expose all these arms deals that probably happened in your hotel and probably ought to be confidential. I think you may be upsetting some people, and I've got to say, you're pretty brave.
Well, that's probably pretty good advice, yeah?
Well, and 2 weeks later, his son turned up dead in a car crash
right.
in Paris, and his girlfriend was Diana.
Right,
I don't
right.
think she was the target. I think his son was the target.
I see. So it might have had something to do with arms dealing or whatever, or the expose of that. The family was exposing something, maybe.
Yeah, it's very interesting because somebody who contacted me, they contacted me because they wrote a book about the death of Diana, and they asked if they could quote that, and I said, yes. And he said, you do realize you're the only person who's come across who has that theory. And I said, look, I don't know whether it's true or not. None of us actually know whether that was an accident or not an accident. We don't know for certain. We're all engaging in conjecture. But my trail took me a particular place, and that was my conclusion. Take it or leave it. But the author of that book got back in touch with me and said, you know, I've been following the news about Diana, and you do realize that the more information is coming out, the more information there is that it was arms dealers who caused the accident. And I said, yes, I've been paying attention to that. And he said, kind of looks like they're getting closer and closer to your view of things. I said, well, just as long as they don't get closer and closer to me, I don't mind.
Well, you know, another assertion was that Princess Diana, if she was to marry his son, then that might expose William to an Arab faction. They didn't want to be that close. Yeah.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about whether the royal family was involved in this or not.
Right.
The royal family have a lot of money, but, you know, you remember that show, Married with Children?
I don't watch television that much, so I don't know that much about it.
Okay, well, some of your listeners will remember Married with Children was a comedy show back in the very dysfunctional family. That is the royal family. It is basically just that family with a lot of money. They don't have the intelligence or the connections or the desire to become involved in that sort of activity. And in fact, this is the interesting thing. The person who is peddling that angle the most is Mohammed Al-Fayed. And my view is he is peddling that story about the British royal family to divert its attention from him.
Right.
That's my view. And I went to him and I told him that. And he didn't write back to me.
You know what you're describing, you know the 007 novels, right?
Yes.
Right? There's an organization in there called Spectre. Remember that?
Yes.
And to me, I've looked at this stuff for about 35 years pretty, closely, you know. And this system that has developed and evolved and right between the largest corporate interest and the money, the big money, and then all these different intelligence and central banks resembles something like Spectre, you know, to me.
Well,
you know,
Jane
I mean,
Bond,
yeah,
as you will know, was written by Ian Fleming, who was an officer in British intelligence.
Yeah.
And another very well-known author of spy fiction is John le Carré. And both of them, it's acknowledged that both of them were using their fiction to reveal stuff that they knew to be true, but they couldn't actually come out and write it as nonfiction because they didn't sue. So, you know, I don't think there's actually an organization called Spectre, but are multinational companies powerful? Do they organize their own operations? Yeah, I'm pretty sure they do. That's kind of what I'm talking about in my book.
Right, right.
Although,
yeah. What I'm saying is that if you look at Spectre in the Wikipedia definition, you're going to find something that sounds similar to what has been going on, but on a worldly basis, international basis. So, not that there is an organization called that, but it's, but it seems like the dynamics are similar. See what I mean?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things that I discovered, about intelligence activity.
Yeah.
Meeting with Israeli intelligence officers and British intelligence officers is that the way that it works is absolutely nothing like you see in the movies. There is, for instance, British assassins, they are not people like Daniel Craig living in the Caribbean and driving expensive cars. They are ordinary people who live across the street from you and go about their ordinary lives. Look at my friend. He was an ordinary guy involved in extraordinary things. And this, again, is why we have to be vigilant. I'm not saying people start looking through your neighbor's bathroom windows, but don't go looking in strange places for assassins or arms dealers. They're ordinary people who go home to their wives at the end of the day, and you have to look for strange things happening around you and see what's behind it.
Right. Did you have a lot of luck in discovering some of these important members of the secret underworld, or did you get tips from different people along the way?
The most important thing I did, George, and this is really a tip for everybody, is I just went and knocked on people's doors, literally. I had no grounding, I had no knowledge, I had no expertise. I'm not a reporter. I'm not a spook. I'm not a law enforcement official. The only thing I was a lawyer. All I knew to do was ask questions, and I'm pretty good at asking questions. And so I would just brazenly go and ask questions of people. My starting point was this gentleman in Scotland who I knew to be, who Hugh had told me had been involved with him in British intelligence, and I literally went up to Scotland with a friend and knocked on his door. And I've been asked, okay, you keep on saying you're ordinary, so why would these extraordinary people speak to you? You know, I have no clue, George. But it would often say to me was that they were speaking to me. Are you still there, George?
Yeah, I'm here. It's fascinating. Your story is fascinating. That's why.
They spoke to me because they were amused as much as anything else. I mean, this guy in Scotland just sat there with a smile on his face saying, I'm not going to tell you any of this, but why are you here? And I kept telling him stuff, and he said, okay, you've told me enough. I'm kind of intrigued. This really is a really dangerous conversation for you to be having with somebody you don't know. And I found that more and more, like the time the Israeli intelligence officer, Harry, took me to dinner in Israel, in Montreal, that they spoke to me because they genuinely believed, they worked out I wasn't part of their game. That I was genuinely who I said I was. I was a friend of somebody who was trying to find out the truth of his children. And you know something, George, it's kind of weird. And maybe this is just in my mind. These people operate in a dark, mysterious place. They are, as Harry explained to me, he said, we're basically bad people. And you know something, you sort of brought a ray of goodness into our lives, and we actually feel good talking to you. And I said, that's it. That's what I've got to tell my listeners, is that you spoke to me because you kind of think I'm good. Yeah, okay.
What do you think, psychopathic type of personality types are what some of these people exhibit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, very definitely.
They don't have a conscience if they kill somebody. They don't have a conscience about it. Right.
I wouldn't ever want them babysitting my kids. But
right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, now let me. Do you have anything? We've got about 4.5 minutes left in the program. Do you have any closing comments here that you'd like to make before we close down the program?
I think basically the same pitch I made before, which is to your listeners, which is I didn't go looking for an adventure. I found one. I didn't go looking for an expose. I'm told I have come up with all sorts of aspects of American and British clandestine activity that nobody else has. But I would say to your listeners, I think we all feel the same way, that we feel that we no longer control our lives, but we can by starting, as you say, George, locally and asking questions. And if you want to know how to do it, that more than any other reason is a good reason to buy Maggie's Hammer, because it will show you the way. That's my pitch, George.
It's a wonderful book, Maggie's Hammer, and the author is Jeff Gilson. Some of my own closing comments here would be about the Syrian situation and the Iraq and all that, it's unimaginable what's happening there, isn't it?
Well, it is unimaginable, and the interesting thing from my point of view is that I see the same activity there that I describe in my book.
Yes.
Britain, the British are selling arms illegally to people the Americans want them to sell to. The British are supplying factions of the Syrian opposition because the Americans can't. They're still acting as a surrogate for the Americans in their clandestine activity around the
right,
world.
Right,
although my
right.
Although my book starts in the 80s, it's still relevant today.
Right. Jeff Gilson, I enjoyed speaking with you, and you really had some very interesting things to say. And like I've said just a few minutes ago, the Syrian situation mirrors many of those, but on it's four or five times worse than maybe what was happening in the 80s. You know, it seems like that. It's just the factions, this ISIS is over there. There's a takedown occurring of this Assad government. There's arms dealings from all factions. The Russians are involved now. And then the Egyptians have met with the Russians three times in Moscow, Assisi, head of the Egyptian government. So there's factions there that are developing. So that's very interesting, too.
Yes, indeed.
Well, look, I want to thank you. We want to thank you very much for being with us this evening, and keep up the good work. And Maggie's Hammer, author Jeff Gilson, thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you for having me, George.
Okay, good night.
Good night now.
I want to thank again Jeffrey Gilson for being with us tonight on the very interesting second hour interview. He's the author of Maggie's Hammer, just to reiterate a second. And he's English, and his best friend died, and he wanted to find out. And so he did an investigation and dug down real deep into what was going on over there in England and came up with some very, very insightful dynamics of money laundering and arms dealing, things like this. During the Thatcher administration, his good friend, Hugh Simmons was one of Margaret Thatcher's favorite speechwriters, and so they were pretty close politically to, they were all within the Conservative Party, and everyone was very knowledgeable and friendly with Margaret Thatcher at that time. So he did give an insight into what is going on over there and what are some of the real dynamics. I mean, we've got to try to understand this world system. And what I have found out in my studies over 30 plus years is that it's far more evil than you could ever imagine. What we're covering on this program, Charlotte Littlefield and I, is just a scratch in the surface of what's really going on out there. And what's really going on out there is very, very evil. And it's indescribable. It's far beyond any fiction that you could ever imagine and so forth. But anyway, we want to thank you for listening tonight. TheSecretTruth.com. You can access it for on demand replay of these programs. And thank you very much for being with us. I've got a book, Be Good to Yourself. Go to Amazon, check that out, see what you think about that. It's about forgiveness and about love thy neighbor. It doesn't have scripture in there, but it tries to convey some very positive things that can be helpful for all of us to learn about. Thank you for listening. Good night. Thank you.